Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, Iowa primary voters have picked their nominees. Joining us to evaluate the races that we're examining for the first time today for the November general election. Dennis Goldford is with us, professor of political science, department chair at Drake University in Des Moines. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Ben.
Your colleague joins us, Rachel Caulfield, in our Des Moines studio, associate professor of political science at Drake. Hi, Rachel.
Hi.
We want to have our listeners join us this hour as well, listening to Dennis and Rachel talk about these matchups. We want to hear from you. What race has you most excited as we examine the matchups for November for the first time? 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Email us, river2river@iowapublicradio.org. We'll get to the congressional races, the four districts here in Iowa in just a moment, but let's talk about the race for governor. Des Moines businessman Fred Hubbell won the Democratic nomination for governor yesterday. He bested four other candidates with 55% of the vote. In his victory speech last night, Hubbell wasted no time laying blame for Iowa's problems at the feet of Governor Reynolds.
You know, it used to be you could talk to folks on the other side of the aisle. You know what that was like. You might disagree on how you solve a problem, but at least you would agree on what the problem was. Well, when I look at these last two legislative sessions, it's clear to me the problem is Governor Reynolds. And an extreme agenda that's taking our state backwards and tearing us apart.
Governor Reynolds was unopposed in yesterday's primary, but started the general election season last night by portraying Hubbell as a wealthy man out of touch with the pocketbook issues most Iowans face.
And the issue isn't that Fred Hubbell has been rich his entire life. It's that he has no idea what it's like not to be. He has no idea what it's like to balance a family checkbook or to make the tough decisions most of us make each and every day when we're trying to make ends meet.
Okay. A few of the words from the contenders for governor in our November election. Indeed, Fred Hubbell pouring $3 million of his own money into this campaign, raised about $4 million more. Dennis Goldford, was that what made the difference?
Well, money always helps. It's necessary, but it's not sufficient. Otherwise, it would always be the case that whoever spends the most money will win the election. And while that happens most of the time, it doesn't happen every time. But certainly in the Democratic primary, Mr. Hubbell had the money to be on the air for quite some time. John Norris was on the air toward the very end. You never saw Mr. Wilburn. And, of course, several of the other candidates, Andy McGuire and Kathy Glasson and Mr. Bolton, were also on the air as well at times, but not as much as Fred Hubbell. The difficulty for Fred Hubbell, and it's partly what Governor Reynolds started working on last night, was that he's considered to be, fairly or not, he's considered to be a fairly urban, Des Moines-centered kind of person, not well known outside of Des Moines. And so one of the things Fred Hubbell has had to do with all those television advertisements is to begin to define himself among voters who live in parts of the state outside of the Des Moines metro area.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, what do you think? Is that Fred Hubbell's challenge to get out of the mold that the current governor is quickly trying to shape around him?
Yeah, I mean, this is a guy who has centered his career around the Des Moines area. He is a wealthy business person. There's no way around that. Much of his campaign was self-financed. And so figuring out how to craft a narrative for his campaign that presents himself in a way that's relatable to the average everyday Iowan in a general election is going to be his primary challenge.
Mm-hmm. the decisiveness, Rachel, to you to hear on this, 55% of the vote, that's way above the hurdle that needed to be met in order to win this outright.
Yeah, and I have no doubt that the Hubble campaign is extremely pleased by this outcome. Across, I believe, just about every county in Iowa, Fred Hubble was victorious. And it was a pretty massive win. Remember that we didn't have a lot of polling in this race. So, you know, we didn't really know where voters were. The one poll we did have showed Hubble at 31%, and his closest challenger was Nate Bolton at 20%. And of course, Nate Bolton dropped out of the campaign. So we weren't sure where those 20% of voters would go. But in addition, there was another 24% in the poll who said that they were undecided at the time. So that's 44% of primary goers who we really had no idea where they were going to land. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the fact that so many of them went to Hubble had to be really gratifying for their campaign.
Jeff Kaufman, the chair of the Iowa GOP, getting on the bandwagon with Governor Reynolds to try to shape this narrative you just mentioned there, Rachel. Here's a tweet from him today. As expected, Prince Frederick Hubble found enough spare change to purchase the Democratic nomination tonight. I guess a tweet from last night, obviously.
I would note that I don't recall Jeff Kaufman or Kim Reynolds making comments like that about billionaire Donald Trump. So that doesn't seem to apply in that regard. But, of course, this is going to be the Reynolds campaign will run as Joni Ernst 2.0. In other words, in 2014, Joni Ernst very successfully, very cleverly, very ably ran a campaign portraying her as just a good old Iowa country girl with good old rural values against that wealthier big city slicker lawyer in the case of Bruce Braley. And it worked in 2014. Much of the Trump election was this sort of revenge of rural and small town America against urban and metropolitan America that worked for Donald Trump. And so the Reynolds campaign pretty clearly is going to take that tack, even if they're not quite consistent in complaining about Mr. Hubble's wealth and not Mr. Trump's wealth.
During our conversation, Dennis Goldford and Rachel Caulfield with us of Drake University, our political scientists, picking apart the primary results initially here in Iowa. We'll ask for their overview nationally. There were seven other states, I believe. So we'll look towards how this lines up for the congressional races in the November election. Let's go to Danielle in Woodward. Danielle dialed 1-866-780-9100. Danielle, welcome to the program. What are your thoughts on this post-primary day?
I would love an opinion of your guests about a running mate for Fred Hubble. I would personally love to see him choose the fiery and trustworthy Kathy Glosson. She would bring a lot of dynamics to the campaign. Mm-hmm. She would bring along the Sanders folks, and but she might be too volatile. What do you guys think?
Rachel, let's go to you. That's a great question because mm-hmm. Bernie Sanders, very, very strong 2 years ago against Hillary Clinton, of course.
Yeah, and I think one of the things we were keeping an eye on last night was how well Kathy Glosson did in the gubernatorial race and how well Pete D'Alessandro did. Pete D'Alessandro, of course, the campaign manager for Bernie Sanders in Iowa. He was running in the 3rd District congressional primary last night. And neither one of them cracked through the way that Bernie supporters might have hoped. And so, you know, there have been a couple national news outlets who have said this is evidence that that Bernie Sanders phenomenon from 2016 has not succeeded in taking over the Democratic Party. You know, we definitely saw establishment candidates do really well last night. Having said that, I think, you know, a lot of people have proposed that Fred Hubble's going to need to put a woman on the ticket as lieutenant governor candidate. I've heard Liz Mathis's name thrown around quite a lot. And I know a lot of Kathy Glosson supporters would certainly advocate for her like Danielle does.
Mm-hmm. Your thoughts on a running mate, Dennis?
Well, I think I'd go with Rachel in that regard. I think it's more important. Well, it's important both ways in terms of having a woman on the ticket. But especially having someone from outside of urban Iowa on the ticket. Now, that being said, I don't know a lot of studies that suggest that really the right running mate will change the election. We always have that issue when we talk about vice presidential nominees at the federal level. But I think for right now, the thing that should concern Hubble supporters is, and Rachel, correct me if I'm wrong, we both listened to Kathy Glasson's speech, at least insofar as it was broadcast last night, her concession speech. I don't remember her mentioning Fred Hubble, certainly not by name, and certainly not in the sense of unifying the party. And that's got to be of some concern to the Hubble campaign, whoever ends up being the running mate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would note, you know, she definitely, in her speech last night, made a big statement about the movement that the right. Bernie Sanders supporters have come together to support. And she said that, you know, the fight continues regardless of who's in office or which party wins. It's not a ringing endorsement for unification of the Democratic Party. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, how she would do on the campaign trail, she and Fred Hubble have very different campaign styles, and they have different policy views.
Join our conversation with Rachel Caulfield, Dennis Goldford at Drake University as we look over the primary results from yesterday and look forward to the general election campaign, which starts in earnest now. Let's go to our congressional races. And please, River to River listeners, join us and tell us what race has you most excited as we examine the matchups for November for this first day after the primary. Let's go to the first district. First congressional district in northeast Iowa, judged to be one of the most competitive congressional districts in the country. Democrat Abby Finkenauer will face the incumbent Republican Representative Rod Blum in the general election. The two-term state representative beat out three other Democrats in the race for Iowa's congressional district won the nomination for the Democrats. Let's listen to a bit of her. She told supporters last night in this clip that the upcoming general election would have less to do with parties than with people.
2018, and you've heard me say this before, but I firmly believe it, is not going to come down to whether you're a Democrat or Republican. It's going to come down to whether you care about people or do you not.
Okay. Rachel, introduce us to Abby Finkenauer here. I've seen some ads online and so forth. She's come out there as a young voice for the Democrats. Is this the one that can give a serious challenge to Rod Blum?
She's a very young, new voice in the Democratic Party. She's 28 years old, and she'd be the youngest woman ever elected to Congress, if elected.
In the nation?
Yeah, I believe that's true. Youngest woman ever elected. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think that's true. So she, you know, she's been seen as a rising star in Iowa politics. This is an extremely competitive race. All national outlets are rating it as a toss-up. Remember that Democrats need to take 23 seats in the House in order to regain control. So they're going to target this heavily. The Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee had specifically supported Abby Finkenauer as their preferred candidate. And so, you know, she, I think, will receive a lot of national attention for this campaign. And right now, I think the National Democratic Party sees this as a campaign that's entirely winnable.
Mm-hmm. At the same time, I would note that in 2016, Rod Blum was considered to be endangered, considered to be very much of a toss-up race. And Blum won that race over Monica Vernon by over 29,000 votes, about 54% to 46%. Vernon won Black Hawk and Linn counties, very big counties for Democrats over there, just barely, and lost every other county in the district, and didn't have enough of a margin in those two big Democratic counties to beat Rod Blum. So he's been endangered and in toss-up status before. That's not to say he couldn't lose this time, but I wouldn't think that Abby Finkenauer should be going shopping for office furniture yet.
Mm-hmm. No, I would agree with that. This is going to be a hard-fought race.
Our executive producer, Catherine, just did some fact-checking on what you said. You are indeed right. It would be Abby Finkenauer would be the youngest woman elected to Congress at the age of 28. The youngest woman to date, 30 years old. And so that would be a history-making mark. But let's talk a little bit about the first district in this race, because it is a district that where incumbent Rod Blum has had two terms where voters registered no party, outnumbering either Democrats or Republicans, Dennis, right? I mean, when you have a district like that, how unusual is it?
Well, in Iowa, three out of the four districts have a plurality of no-party registrants, just as statewide no-party registrants are the plurality, followed by Republicans, followed by Democrats. Only in Steve King's fourth district is there a plurality of Republicans, followed narrowly behind by no-party and way behind by Democrats. But the second has been considered, the first has been considered to be, generally speaking, a Democratic district, both before and after the last reapportionment and redistricting, which is why Democrats are so keen to take it back. But as we know, in all cases in Iowa, you can't do it by yourself. Neither the Republicans nor the Democratic candidates can do it by themselves. They've got to win significant support from supposed no-party voters.
Mm-hmm. When we have a highly contested or highly competitive race, as judged in the national scene, Rachel, we can expect a lot of money to be poured into the Finkenauer-Blum race, can't we?
We can expect a lot of money to be poured into that race. We can expect a lot of national attention. And, of course, this is Iowa in 2018. We'll have a lot of national political figures come out, partially to support our candidates and partially to set themselves up for potential runs in 2020.
Let's move to another competitive district in a moment after I remind listeners who may have just joined us. You're listening to Rachel Caulfield, Dennis Goldford, our political analysts on this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River, the day following the 2018 primaries here in Iowa. Join our conversation with a question for one of our analysts, or perhaps just tell us what race has you most excited, energized as we examine the matchups for November for the first time. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Cindy Axne won the three-way Democratic primary election in Iowa's 3rd congressional district last night, the 3rd district in southwest Iowa, 16 counties, also the cities of Des Moines and Council Bluffs. Axne won the Democratic primary with about 58% of the vote. There again, very decisive. She'll face the two-term Republican Congressman David Young in the November election. Axne asked supporters last night to help her reach across the aisle.
I'm calling on all of you to help me keep this ride going, that we make sure that we reach out to everybody across the aisle and we get all Iowans engaged in this campaign so that we can have a victory in November and make sure that Iowans have a voice in Congress.
Dennis, assess this third district race.
Well, we have, again, a district in which you have no-party voters, a slight plurality, and Republicans a plurality over Democrats. In 2016, David Young won over Jim Maurer, becoming, unfortunately, a kind of perpetual candidate, but Jim Maurer, by about 53,500 votes, 54 to 40%. Maurer won Polk County, which is, again, a Democratic bastion where you've got to run up a big majority, by 270 votes. That's all. And he lost every other county in the district. So Cindy Axne, who's very impressive, I wasn't familiar with her before the primary season, and very good advertising. She's got to run up big numbers in Polk County.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, your view of this race?
Well, so this is a more Republican electorate, I think, naturally, than the first district is. It's been targeted for sure by the National Democratic Party. So the DCCC has rated this as one of its top targets. The district voted overwhelmingly for Obama in 2008 and 2012 by double digits in both cases, but then narrowly went for Trump by just under 4 points in 2016. So I think there's a question as to whether or not the district itself is changing, or is this a case where the Democrats have a real shot? As Dennis noted, David Young has won by overwhelming margins in both of his previous elections. He won by 11 points and he won by 14 points. Mm-hmm. So, I think it's fair to rate this as a likely Republican win, but certainly the Democrats are going to put a lot of time and effort into trying to flip this district.
Dennis, elaborate on and perhaps what Rachel mentioned there a moment ago. We talked about, you know, Bernie Sanders, the Bernie power lingering in the state following 2016. Pete D'Alessandro was in this race. He was Bernie Sanders' top aide in Iowa during that 2016 caucus. Yet last night, finishing a distant third, what does this say about the progressive power of the Democratic Party in Iowa, if anything?
Well, I think both political parties are in a period of turmoil regarding self-definition. You know, conservatives didn't regard Trump as conservative. National Review, a standard classical conservative journal, had a whole issue dedicated to the proposition of anybody but Trump on the Republican side. And Democrats have still been trying to figure out who they are ever since Ronald Reagan. And what we've seen more recently is this conflict between those who consider themselves to be more liberal or progressive, who opted for Bernie Sanders, and people who consider themselves more liberal in a centrist kind of way, who are very willing to work with Wall Street and big corporations and so forth. And that, of course, was Hillary Clinton. And the defeat of Hillary Clinton didn't solve the conflict since, of course, though she lost the electoral vote and thus the presidency, she won the popular vote. And so you hear people like Kathy Glasson and Pete D'Alessandro saying, again, you know, the reason we're losing is not because we're not centrist enough. It's because we're too centrist. We need to be much more liberal or progressive. And that's a fight that's still underway.
Mm-hmm. And you heard Kathy Glasson in the primary debate, in that last debate, she referred to the mushy middle. Right. That they shouldn't go towards the mushy middle. And this is the kind of rhetoric that we heard from the Tea Party on the Republican side. So when we talk about party divisions, we've been talking for a long time about Republican Party divisions with the rise of the Tea Party. I think we're seeing now this kind of question about the extent to which the Democratic Party is divided.
Mm-hmm. And so you're saying, Rachel, also, it's not clear from yesterday's primary results whether the Democratic Party in Iowa has decided where it wants to be.
Yeah. I mean, in Iowa, clearly last night, the preferred candidates were the more centrist candidates, the more establishment-oriented, institutionally-oriented candidates, rather than the kind of more progressive Bernie Sanders-allied candidates. And remember, Bernie Sanders, I mean, he came to Iowa. He did a commercial for Pete D'Alessandro. He did a voice robocall for Bernie Sanders. Mm-hmm. So he put a lot of effort into this.
Okay. We'll be back in just a moment with Rachel Caulfield, Dennis Goldford of Drake University, as we analyze the politics of the primary season here in Iowa. We'll talk about the other districts we haven't, the second and the fourth briefly, and then on to the national scene to look at the general election from a national perspective, and then on to some other national politics as well. We hope you join us. Our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Ben Kiefer back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
And we're back midstream in this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Dennis Goldford with us and Rachel Caulfield of Drake University. One day past the primary here in Iowa and seven other states, going through the congressional districts. We talked about the governor matchup, and let's talk about the two remaining congressional districts we haven't onto the national scene, and then we'll talk about some developments in the Russia investigation as well. The second district, let me put that in your hands, Rachel. Dr. Christopher Peters, a rematch to face incumbent Democrat. This is the sole Democrat in Iowa's congressional delegation, one of six. How do you see this matchup again?
I expect that Dave Loebsack has all the advantages of incumbency. The big population centers in the 2nd District favor him dramatically. I don't think it will be the same kind of competitive race that we'll see in the 1st and the 3rd.
Mm-hmm. The 4th District, J.D. Shulton of Sioux City. Dennis, he's a former professional baseball player. He won the Democratic nomination for this district. He has a uphill battle, if we are to judge it by past races that Steve King has won, going back to his first election in Congress in 2002, right, in Iowa's 4th District.
Right. Well, Steve King evidently represents that district extremely well, even if critics say that he hasn't really sponsored much in the way of legislation. The people of the 4th District love Steve King. Now, despite the fact of that the 4th District includes Ames, Mason City, and Fort Dodge, recall it's a very rural, very thinly populated district. We know when you do apportionment, every district's supposed to have, at least right after a census, the same number of people in a state as every other district. And it takes 39 counties that make up the 4th to have as many people as are in the 16 counties that make up the third. So that shows you how thinly dispersed the population is. But there's a strong Christian conservative evangelical component to the 4th District. And basically, other than a few dissenters, Steve King seems to do no wrong so far. So, yes, Mr. Shulton has an uphill race. Lightning can always strike in politics, but for Steve King, at least as of yet, there aren't really any clouds in the sky.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, comment about the continued trend through these 2018 primaries, continuing yesterday. Female candidates winning. We talked about Cindy Axne, Abby Finkenauer here in Iowa, but also in California. I'm seeing in South Dakota, New Mexico. So is this really something new that we're seeing, and why would we... Not the general election yet. They haven't been elected to office. But in terms of primaries, they are coming through.
Yeah, Democrats in particular have made a lot of the fact that there are a lot of new voices and first-time candidates running in this cycle that may not have otherwise been involved. And they attribute that to the election of President Trump, but also the Me Too movement, kind of a growing political awareness among particularly young women and women of color. Having said that, some of the women that we're watching in the general elections for November are Republican women. So it's not just Democratic women who are getting involved and more prominent in this election cycle. Obviously, in Iowa, we have Cindy Axne and Abby Finkenauer, but we're also watching Young Kim in California. She was the first Korean-American Republican woman to become a state lawmaker in California. She's running in California 39th. And then in South Dakota, we have Republican Kristi Noem, who's likely to become the state's first woman governor. In New Mexico, a Democrat, Deb Haaland, is likely to become the first Native American congresswoman. So we have some really interesting firsts coming up, particularly firsts for women.
Mm-hmm. Dennis, what do you see when you look outside of Iowa to these primary results nationally?
Well, I've said in another context that I think that there is a kind of blue wave that everybody talks about right now, but a blue wave of candidates, such as all sorts of young people, particularly female candidates, putting themselves forward on the Democratic side especially. What remains to be seen is whether there will be a blue wave of voters in November. Because, again, as we've talked about on the show quite often, the midterm electorate has a Republican tilt, at least much more of one than a general presidential election year electorate has. Because Republicans think voting is important, and they tend to turn out to vote. A lot of them are older who vote more regularly than younger people. And Democrats, particularly dependent upon single women, young people, and minorities, tend not to get the kind of turnout in the past to succeed in a midterm election. So, yes, there's been across this wave of this number of primaries, and we've seen some successes in Alabama and Virginia and places like that. There's been this greater enthusiasm on the part of Democrats in particular, But, you know, you don't need to generate much enthusiasm to invigorate somebody that seems barely conscious. And that's the way so many of the Democratic voters have been in past midterms. So this is a good sign for Democrats. But again, it doesn't seal the deal. We don't know about that till November.
Dennis Goldford and Rachel Caulfield are political analysts on this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. Let's switch our scope to look at the Russia investigation, some interesting developments there. Well, once again, today, this is getting to be a pattern. Donald Trump, the president, attacking his own. Yes, the attorney general that he picked, Jeff Sessions. Sessions, his tweet this yesterday, latest in this series, the Russian witch hunt hoax continues, tweeted the president, all because Jeff Sessions didn't tell me he was going to recuse himself. I would have quickly picked someone else. So much time and money wasted, so many lives ruined, and Sessions knew better than most that there was no collusion. So obviously the president continuing to vent that he's mad at the attorney general. And for not shutting down the Russia investigation. This tweet, I'll add to this before for the comment, before you comment, this is from early Monday morning, the president's tweet, as has been stated by numerous legal scholars, I have the absolute right to pardon myself, but why would I do that when I have done nothing wrong? In the meantime, the never-ending witch hunt, led by 13 very angry and conflicted Democrats and others, continues into the midterms. Well, this is a lot of reaction from both Democrats and Republicans here. Here's one from our own Republican senior Senator Chuck Grassley when asked by CNN in an interview.
If I were president of the United States and I had a lawyer that told me I could pardon myself, I think I'd hire a new lawyer.
Okay. I think I'd hire a new lawyer. Of course, the attorney here he's speaking of is Rudolph Giuliani, saying that the president's power extends so far that in no case could he be subpoenaed or indicted. Also, Giuliani going as far to say as if he shot James Comey, he'd be impeached the next day. Impeach him, and then you can do whatever you want to do with him. You can't indict him while he's in office. So, Dennis, I know you're a constitutional scholar here. This is, must have been some real fodder for you to chew over.
Well, it's sort of one of these things you scratch your head in amazement and think, what in the world is going on here? There's so many angles we can take on this. Number one, to a great extent, nobody knows where this goes because we don't have any history of it. Richard Nixon resigns before articles of impeachment were successfully passed, and I think that with Bill Clinton there was a question of a subpoena from Ken Starr, but basically they agreed to work it out before the subpoena was issued. So again, you get into all sorts of legal technicalities, most of which are best left to the lawyers, but the thought that a president could pardon himself, and again we remember a president can pardon only for matters of federal law, supposedly, not state law. So if you're called into court for some state particular state issue or state complaint or crime, the president can't pardon you for that. He can pardon only in federal matters, at least as far as what I've read has indicated. But the thought that he could pardon himself raises the concern in a lot of people that that suggests that the president, in some sense, is above the law. You know, to say that suppose you did in a fit of anger, suppose the president did shoot a member of his staff. Most people want to say, do you really mean that we have absolutely no way of dealing with this? I mean, if that's the case, there is a fundamental legal, if not moral, flaw in the Constitution. That's what's of concern to people, and Republicans have to remember when they decide how to react to this, what if this were Barack Obama or Bill Clinton making these arguments? You know, they would be just ballistic if a Democratic president were making those arguments.
Mm-hmm. Rachel, how are Republicans, members of Congress, reacting to these claims? We heard Senator Grassley there. The very quotable comment there, if I were the president of the United States and I had a lawyer that said I could pardon myself, I would hire a new lawyer.
Right.
this is significant coming from the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee if this process gets to the point of impeachment, isn't it?
Well, absolutely it is. And you know, I think the question of impeachment is important here only because, right, virtually every Republican has basically said, look, we actually constitutionally don't know if the president has the power to pardon himself. This has been brought up really only twice. There was an Office of Legal Counsel memo in 1974 about it. It was briefly discussed during the Clinton impeachment. And so, you know, we don't know constitutionally. The Constitution actually doesn't mention this specifically in any way. So it's never been adjudicated. We don't know the answer. But if the president were to do that, regardless of whether it's a constitutional problem, it is absolutely a political problem. So they've kind of nicely said, President Trump, you may be kind of toying with this legally, and you may have lawyers who are toying with this legally, but trust us when we tell you that politically, if you were to try to pardon yourself, it would be a disaster.
Well, but we don't know exactly. You know, would Republicans in the House indeed vote to impeach and in the Senate vote to convict if he were to do that? Chuck Grassley's comment notwithstanding, that's the question. I mean, you know, Madison's famous argument in Federalist 51 was that ambition must be made to counteract ambition. The interests of the man must be connected with or tied to the interests of the office, so that members of Congress have, they've sworn an oath not to uphold Donald Trump, which has frustrated him to a great extent, but to uphold the Constitution. And when, if you can make an argument that the Constitution conflicts with party, how do you choose? And that really would be the moment of decision for Republicans, just as Republicans said it was the moment of decision for Democrats with Bill Clinton in 1998.
Mm. Now, to reiterate, Giuliani did say that, you know, if why you would bring this up, but he said if he shot James Comey, he'd be impeached the next day. So and then what, after a president, should a president be impeached, then Dennis, then after that, he's fair game for an indictment? Is that the way we're reading it?
Well, once he's out of office,
right?
Once he's out of office. And that's remember why supposedly Gerry Ford granted a pardon to Richard Nixon. Basically, you know, Ford's first speech said, you know, our long national nightmare is over. And it cost Ford the presidency probably in 1976, but in that sense, he put the country over his own particular partisan political interests. So, that in fact could occur. Supposedly, you know, while the president's in office, the president's too busy dealing with matters of state, domestic and foreign, to be tied up in some sort of criminal or other such trials. This was the big mistake of the Supreme Court in Clinton versus Jones, where the Supreme Court, and I think, Rachel, wasn't it written by Justice Stevens, who was a moderate Republican who became more liberal, who actually said, oh, no, this won't cause a big stir. The president could be required to testify in a civil suit. And we know where that went.
Mm. Yes, the Monica Lewinsky testimony. Often repeated on these airwaves during this particular time slot of Politics Wednesday. Dennis Goldford, Rachel Caulfield with us. 5 or so minutes left here. A couple things we want to scamper through here. Another development in the Russia investigation. Former Trump campaign chair Paul Manafort accused of witness tampering. This is another one where you roll your eyes, isn't it, Rachel? A federal judge ordering yesterday Manafort to respond to prosecutors' claims that he sought to tamper with the testimony of two potential witnesses for his upcoming trial on charges of money laundering and failing to register as a foreign agent. These are serious charges, Rachel.
Yeah, these are serious charges.
Tampering with a witness, you don't get much more serious than that, right?
No, you really don't. And, you know, Manafort's situation just seems to be getting worse and worse. And to a great extent, I think a lot of his critics in particular would say he's done this to himself, right? So it'll be interesting to see how quickly this case proceeds and the degree to which any of this information gets out into the public prior to the midterm elections. Because I think as this information continues to dribble out into the public, you end up with, you know, a greater need for Republicans to respond directly to it.
Mm-hmm. The other big political news from the football field into the world of politics, the president escalating his war with the Super Bowl champion Philadelphia Eagles. He hosted a short celebration without the team. Sarah Huckabee Sanders, his spokeswoman, accusing the Super Bowl champions of turning their White House invitation into a political stunt. Wow. Dennis, what do you make of this uninvitation? The president putting this front and center again?
Well, number one, he did not want to be embarrassed by a bunch of no-shows. You don't want to give a party and have nobody show up. But, you know, there's an old tradition with presidents in this country of both parties of doing something the political scientists call wrapping yourself in the flag. And that's where you say, well, you're not criticizing me. You're criticizing the country. You're criticizing America. And so you hide from criticism of yourself by wrapping yourself in the flag and accuse your critics of going after what it means to be an American. And Donald Trump plays that very well. You know, a number of commentators have said recently that Donald Trump is not president of the United States. He's president of his base. And in many ways, I think that is the case. You know, if Barack Obama came to fame by saying there are no red states of America and blue states of America, there are only the United States of America, Donald Trump is trying to erase so many things that Obama did properly or not. He seems to be going back to this idea, no, there are no United States of America. There are only red states or blue states.
Plenty of other things we could talk about. Unfortunately, our hour is come to an end. We have an anniversary, a tragic anniversary, to think back about this week. 50 years ago, Robert F. Kennedy left the ballroom of the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles after he declared victory in California's presidential primary. It was moments later he walked through the kitchen to greet the hotel's staff there, the busboys, the dishwashers. He was shot and killed. Dennis, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'm thinking you would have been a young man when this tragic news hit the country.
I have to admit, yes, I was a college student at the time.
And your memories of 1968, such a tumultuous year, the murder of Martin Luther King Jr. just a couple months before, the Vietnam War, over 500,000 troops in Vietnam, and then the riots at the Chicago DNC and this murder.
Right. I mean, I would come home from the library in college every day, and we didn't have cable channels and things like that. We didn't even have NPR, I don't believe, at that point. Yes, we had automobiles and telephones. But, you know, I'd come home and turn on the TV and find out what sort of parade of horrors happened that day. And there was only three networks then. And, you know, if you had had those events in our 24/7 information world now, as hard as it is right now for us to get through a day with all of these things coming at us, it would have been exponentially worse in 1968.
Mm-hmm. Any thoughts to leave us with us on that point or another, Rachel, as we end this hour?
Well, I would just say, you know, for those of us who study politics, the events of 1968 and the assassination of Bobby Kennedy in particular have really transformed much of the systems, many of the systems that we use today, including our electoral systems, our primary systems, our party organizations. And so, you know, we always kind of look back on 1968 as a defining moment in American politics. So I think it's worth remembering that despite all of the sadness and difficulty and tumult of the time, it really transformed the way we live our politics today.
Okay. Well, we'll leave it there. Rachel Caulfield, Associate Professor of Political Science at Drake University. Dennis Goldford, Department Chair and Professor of Political Science at Drake as well. Thanks for joining us for this Politics Wednesday, Dennis and Rachel.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
And we'll leave you with this well-known song. It was actually written right after the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. River to River is produced by Catherine Perkins, Lindsay Moon, and Emily Woodbury. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.
Could they die young? You know, I just looked around and he's gone. Anybody here seen my old friend John? Can you tell me where he's gone? He freed a lot of people, but it seemed good they die young. I just looked around and he's gone. young. I just look around and he's gone. Didn't you love the things that they stood for? Didn't they try to find some?